Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this February 1st, 2009. Got a great show for you today. We're going to have one of the smartest media analysts in the business there. Our guest will be Susan Douglas, columnist for In These Times, professor of communication, author of many books. Talking about the state of the media today, the way politics are being covered or not being covered, and anything you'd like to talk about, too. So join us today for what should be a wonderful hour here on Media Matters. But first, before we go to Professor Douglas and today's show, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Bringing high-speed broadband to everyone in America would help get the economy back on track, and the Obama administration supports funding better broadband infrastructure. But the question remains, what should government investment actually look like? The New America Foundation's Wireless Future program released a paper called Building a 21st Century Broadband Superhighway that proposes one answer. Sasha Meinrath is the research director of the Wireless Future program and coordinates the Open Technology Initiative. He says our current system is a patchwork of infrastructure that doesn't serve everyone because broadband companies have focused on just the most lucrative markets.
What we've ended up with is a very unequally distributed internet system in the United States. And this is a problem. If we think about this coming era, this information age, this digital era that we are now just beginning, those communities that are left offline will suffer increasing problems because of the lack of service that they face.
Meinrath and the New America Foundation believe we need to think of broadband the same way we think of roads. The public pays for them, and anyone can have access to the infrastructure. Meinrath wants to build fiber optic conduits alongside America's roads.
The idea is that each time a road is ripped up or repaved or improved upon, that you lay fiber at that point in time.
Meinrath wants to tie his broadband superhighway proposal to the omnibus transportation bill that's expected to pass Congress this year.
When you lay down about 1 mile of road, it often costs about $2.5 million. Once you've dug these roads up, the cost of laying down fiber tends to be around $5,000 to $15,000. So you're talking about a tiny fraction of 1% of the cost of this transportation infrastructure. Fiber infrastructure probably costs about the same as laying down the markings on lanes on roads. It's an incredibly efficient use of funding that brings a huge economic activity and benefits to the communities that it would serve.
For more information about the broadband superhighway, go to newamerica.net.
Cut and paste, remix, mashup. All these terms are part of the digital media lexicon, but in the music world, there's an older and more familiar phrase that describes borrowing sounds from another artist, sampling. Kembru McLeod and Benjamin Franzen are the co-producers of Copyright Criminals, This is a Sampling Sport, a documentary on the controversies surrounding copyright, intellectual property, and music. McLeod says the film focuses on the story of hip-hop sampling in particular, a place where new musical styles directly collided with copyright law itself nearly two decades ago.
The reason why it's important to focus on hip-hop when telling the story of these copyright controversies is because it really shows what's at stake. Because hip-hop basically ran into a kind of creative wall about 18 years ago when artists started getting sued. And that was really detrimental to this really important African-American art form.
The intersection of musical style and copyright law may not seem immediately apparent, but the effects of such restrictive legal practices has a direct impact on culture itself.
Let's think back to soul music or jazz, both of which relied heavily on musical borrowing. Imagine if when Ray Charles was about to rewrite that gospel song and turn it into his first big hit, some intellectual property lawyer tapped him on the shoulder and said, "Nope, you can't do that." Or imagine jazz soloists being stopped, you know, John Coltrane, from riffing on a Broadway melody. And that didn't happen back then, and the art was able to evolve. And the same thing wasn't true of hip-hop. And so, in other words, we can look to the relatively recent past to see what the detrimental effects of overzealous copyright protection are.
The 2004 Supreme Court case Bridgeport Music versus Dimension Films laid down the law explicitly on sampling, stating bluntly, get a license or do not sample. We do not see this as stifling creativity in any significant way. As a result, McLeod says, a lot of sampling has just gone back underground.
So you're either within the law and you can pay for the law, basically, or you're a complete outlaw. And that really kind of stopped the evolution of sampling. Basically, by the early 1990s, hip-hop artists had to start paying for every little fragment of sound. It became impossible for them to economically and legally afford to be able to make the art the way they wanted to.
The film will be released this spring. For more information, visit copyrightcriminals.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Hey, it's Bob McChesney. Welcome to Media Matters Today. Hope you enjoyed the musical interlude as usual. It's a wonderful February 1st here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today's show we have as our guest someone we've been wanting to have for quite a long time here at Media Matters. It is Susan Douglas, who is the Catherine Kellogg Professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Michigan. She's written widely numerous books. We've had her on the air to talk about her work in the past, including the book The Mommy Myth, The Idealization of Motherhood and How It Has Undermined Women. And also she's a columnist for In These Times, the monthly news magazine that comes out of Chicago. She writes the column Back Talk. So it's a pleasure to have her with us on the air today. Susan, are you there? Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, you know, there's a lot that's happened in the news since the last time we had you on the program, so there's a lot of ground to cover. First of all, I know that you've been covering electoral politics and the presidential race pretty closely for the last year, and I've spoken to you about it. Just looking back right now, give me your sense, your take on the 2008 presidential race and election and what it means in American history.
Wow, that's a big question. Well, you know, I think we all feel now, thank goodness, that Obama and David Axelrod really ran a very, very smart campaign. And, you know, hats off to them for doing that and for doing it despite, you know, the ongoing idiocies of the mass media and cable news in particular. And, of course, you know, it was an incredibly historic election. And I think one of the things about the coverage that I'd like to talk about is that once Obama won, you know, there was, of course, a lot of commentary about race and what this meant for black folks and the black community. And, of course, you know, prior to the election, there were lots of questions about whether white people would vote for Obama. But there was very little coverage about what his election meant to white people, and especially to white anti-racists in this country. And for us, I mean, it was just such an incredible moment for us, deeply emotional and powerful. And I don't know, for those of us who grew up during the Civil Rights Movement, who've known firsthand what our African-American friends have gone through, both in very significant ways and also in the more minor ways of being, you know, followed around in stores and so on and so forth, this election just meant a huge amount to many, many white people, and that was very undercovered, I thought.
You know, you mentioned already Susan Douglas, I don't know the exact verb he used, but dubious would be a polite way to put it, coverage of the election in the mainstream news media, particularly cable television news. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? What were some of the weaknesses, the core problems you saw during the course of 2008 on the presidential race?
Well, you know, some things never change. And what I find most striking and defeating is that no matter how much criticism, you know, the news media get, and particularly the broadcast media, they're like impervious to it. You know, it just doesn't matter at all because, as you've written about so often and so eloquently, commercial considerations and, of course, their perception of commercial considerations, trumps everything. And so, as usual, we got, this just awful image over substance stuff. And I thought the Jeremiah Wright incident, for example, was a classic case in which, the guy was excoriated for his initial responses. Now, as things progressed, he kind of set himself on fire, you know, the more he got into it. But in that initial speech about 9/11 and in the aftermath of 9/11, what he said was massively distorted on the news, and so you had to go to YouTube. And that's the other thing I think about this election. I think YouTube was an incredible resource for people during this election. It was really a path-breaking election for YouTube. So when you went to YouTube and you saw the full text of what Wright had said in that original speech, and then you saw the comments that people posted, people were shocked, at seeing the full text and seeing at how it had been, completely represented on the mainstream media. Now, of course, you and I could, I think, have a field day with the debates, and especially the Stephanopoulos, Charlie Gibson debate moderation, which was a world-class embarrassment of the first order. You know, the first hour, no questions about substance or policies at all. So I could go on, but I'll stop.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Susan Douglas, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan, author of many books, including The Mommy Myth, and also monthly columnist for In These Times, the Chicago-based monthly news magazine. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Susan Douglas, the number here at WILL-AM580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. One of Susan Douglas's main beats is media coverage of politics. She writes about it all the time. In These Times covers a broad range of issues, so I think pretty much anything in dealing with politics and media is fair game for today's program. One of the issues that you raised, too, about the liberal, about the press coverage, you know, that goes against the dominant meme that we have a liberal bias of our news media. But one issue I think you've probably had to wrestle with is how do you explain Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and the sort of the liberals who've had so much success in prime time on the corporate-owned MSNBC network?
Well, you know, even though we know what the overall commercial corporate biases in the mainstream news media. I mean, they are corporations. They're meant to maximize profits, but they understand that part of the profits come from people who are not conservative. And so even a network, you know, if you take a big media conglomerate like Viacom, which I don't know if you would agree with me, but you might not, but I think is, of course, much more less venal than, say, the News Corporation, they still put Comedy Central on the air. And Comedy Central has been crucial during the Bush years, absolutely crucial. And so, you know, there was a Fox News showed that there was a market for very partisan news coverage that spoke to a particular political base. And so MSNBC began to trot that out, and slowly but surely, Keith Olbermann in particular began to get a lot of coverage. And I think primarily because of his on-air editorials about various heinous Bush policies, those editorials were then circulated as text through a variety of listservs and on the internet, and so it became an echo chamber for Keith Olbermann. And then when Rachel Maddow came on, you know, from Air America, here's a woman who was able to banter with Buchanan. And do so, I think, very effectively, but also with a great sense of humor. And I think she's been fabulous. And, of course, what a lot of people are saying is that she has outstripped Olbermann, both in terms of her, style, as well as her... She's less hysterical in her presentation than Keith Olbermann is. So, I mean, I think it's really showed that there was a market for that kind of coverage. And, of course, people who are liberal and progressive have been desperate for something like that, and the main place we've been able to go is fake news, on Comedy Central. So I think they've shown that there's a real market for that kind of commentary on television.
Susan Douglas, do you think that the Olbermann and Maddow specifically can be characterized as just being the liberal version of Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, or is it just basically the same style of journalism but for liberals as it's often presented, or do you think that is it not an accurate presentation of what they're doing?
I don't think that's accurate because I think O'Reilly, first of all, is a real bully, and by that I mean he does often take on people who are have less power than he. I also think that there's a certain failure to traffic in facts among the right. This is, of course, notoriously true of Rush Limbaugh, but it's also true of O'Reilly as well. And I think if you look at the fun that Jon Stewart has, pretty much every night with clips from Fox News and the completely outrageous, non-fact-based things that get said on there, I don't think it's an equivalence, and I think it's a false equivalence. Now, that doesn't mean that both Fox and MSNBC don't traffic in political opinion. Of course they do, but I think that if you look at who is on Keith Olbermann and who is on Rachel Maddow, these are very respected journalists, people like Frank Rich, Michael Isikoff, people who know their stuff. And so I do think there's a difference, and I think the equivalence is false.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, Professor Susan Douglas from the University of Michigan, author of many books and the columnist every month covering the media beat in her Back Talk column for In These Times, the news magazine that comes out of Chicago, Illinois. Susan, tell our listeners a little bit about In These Times for listeners who may not be familiar with this news magazine.
In These Times was founded in the 1970s. It was for a while a biweekly publication. It's now a monthly, and it is like The Nation. It is a progressive publication, but it sort of historically drew a little bit more from the sort of Midwestern progressive roots that came out of Midwestern progressive politics, actually, in the early 19th century. It covers news, and it has a series of columnists who cover stories from a variety of perspectives. And interestingly, during the Bush years, I think the subscriptions for both The Nation and In These Times went up quite a bit because people were looking for something else. But that's what In These Times is.
Thank you, Susan Douglas. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters and speak with us today, the number here at WILLAM 580-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You know, one of the beats you've had is covering conservative television cable news, specifically, but not exclusively, Fox News over the years, also some of the Rush Limbaugh and talk radio as well. And where do you see conservative media right now, or that right-wing television news and talk radio in America? What's its role today, and how does it compare to what it was doing, during the past 8 years and even during the Clinton years? It seems to me, and let me give you my hypothesis, is that they're sort of in trouble. They're sort of floundering, trying to really find what exactly they're supposed to be doing here.
Well, Bob, I have to confess that during much of the campaign And certainly since the election, I have felt very free not to watch Fox. And it's, you know, that's one of the pleasures I've taken, one of the many multiple pleasures I've taken in this election. But when you have Rush Limbaugh saying, I hope Obama fails, and that was an incredibly incendiary thing to say. And when you think about his saying that and how it resonates with Ari Fleischer's pronouncement back in 2002, 2003, if you're, you know, if people should watch what they say, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists, if you're speaking against the administration, you're, you know, you're basically with the terrorists and so on and so forth. And you think about the Limbaugh comment in that context, it's really quite bracing. And so one doesn't know whether the extremism of that comment is evidence of what you're talking about, that they're really, you know, not quite sure where they're going and what they're going to do. When you have this, you know, enormous outspoken Republican opposition to the stimulus package, when, you know, we have lost over, you know, 2 million jobs in 2008. It's the worst job loss since 1945. And when in one month, in January 2009, we've lost another 200,000 jobs, 200,000 jobs on top of that. And you have these guys saying no to the stimulus package. You just wonder what planet they're on. So I think they see themselves as they're going to continue to be the loyal opposition and so on and so forth. Limbaugh still has his loyal, you know, ditto heads, and I don't think he's going to lose them. But I don't know about, you know, sort of the, you know, the role that Fox and others see for themselves or what might happen to their viewership. Obama is hugely popular right now, and people are desperate for the hopeful message that he has, despite how crummy everything is.
Our guest, Susan Douglas, here at Media Matters. Just to follow up on this, Susan, before we go to our callers who are waiting on the phone lines, you know, I think in the past, just today, Frank Rich in the New York Times wrote a column on Limbaugh and the Republican Party.
Right.
And I suspect you saw the piece, knowing your admiration for Frank Rich.
Yes, I did see it.
And, you know, he refers in there, as I recall, I've been reading a lot this morning about this, prepare for the show, that in the last week, some member of Congress who's a Republican criticized Limbaugh as not the appropriate person to be the mouthpiece for the Republican Party, sends the wrong image. And very soon thereafter was chastised by Limbaugh and sort of came whimpering in to apologize, giving the impression that Rush Limbaugh is, in fact, the de facto voice of the Republican Party nationally, that he's sort of the Pope of the party. What does this say? If that's do you buy that? And if that's true, what does it say about the Republican Party?
Well, I think they're in trouble, and you know, I think probably who's going to emerge as one of their central figures now is going to be Newt Gingrich, and I mean, I never thought I'd say anything praiseworthy about Newt Gingrich, but you know, when the TARP bill was being debated, and it seemed to me a horrible bailout that Paulson was organizing, because it was, you know, none of the I's were dotted at all, to put it mildly. I heard Gingrich on NPR issue a full critique of why this was terrible legislation, and I think most progressives would have agreed exactly with it, and for the same reasons. It was one of those moments, just as when you were organizing, you know, around media consolidation and the relaxing of FCC rules, you know, you helped forge and founded a real powerful alliance between the left and the right on that issue. I think with TARP, there was a lot of anger out in the streets from all ends of the spectrum, and I think Gingrich is the guy who's going to emerge. But I'm hoping maybe we can have a little fun with Sarah Palin, too, at some point. You know, she's just started her own PAC. Did you see this? Sarah PAC?
Yes, I did. And you, I guess you're on the Sarah Palin beat now, Susan. Is that fair to say?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, she's so fascinating. It really is like watching a train wreck over and over. I mean, you know, when she this YouTube thing where she was pardoning the turkey, and the guy behind her is butchering a turkey as she's standing there with her cup of coffee presiding over the pardoning of a turkey. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. So I think she's really, I actually love following her. because it's so surreal. And so she, I mean, her latest thing, you know, she set up this Therapack, and in it, I'll just read a little bit from the website. It proclaims that, and I quote, "The Republican Party is at the threshold of an historic renaissance." And then she says, because its key goals are, and I quote, "healthcare, education, and energy independence." Right? Healthcare, education, and energy independence are key parts of the stimulus package that the Republicans, House Republicans, to a person, vetoed. On she goes. She was asked to speak at the House Republicans retreat this weekend, and she said she was busy. She had to attend to matters in Alaska, and then, oops, there she was in Washington, going to this really swanko party. That's at something called the Alfalfa Club, which is this very, very, you know, elite club that was celebrating Barack Obama. And so she dissed her own party. So, yeah, I do love following Sarah Palin.
Our guest you've just been listening to, Professor Susan Douglas from the University of Michigan, also a monthly columnist for In These Times on the Media Beat in her Back Talk column. The number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's start with line one, Urbana. Thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Douglas.
There was an article in this morning's News Gazette regarding a Rush Limbaugh statement, and they clarified it in that it wasn't a blanket statement wishing that Obama would fail, but just when there are policies instituted by the president that are injurious to the country, it is well and good that they do fail. So that, I think that puts another perspective on it, because it isn't a blanket wish that he would fail in the presidency. But what I wanted to ask you about, one of the criticisms of President Bush was when he instituted the Medicare drug prescription bill, buying drugs for citizens, he did not institute any volume purchase, which he could relatively easily done, which would have been a discount for the citizens, but it would have cost the profits of the pharmaceutical companies, so therefore he didn't put it in. And now that President Obama is in office, I haven't heard one word that he would institute such a measure. And I think this kind of bespeaks volumes of the financial power of the pharmaceutical companies over the president and over the legislators, that they won't have to cut their profits, and therefore it will cost the citizens more money to buy their drugs. Would you comment on that aspect?
Well, thank you very much, caller, for making that call. And, yes, Susan Douglas, now Obama's in power. Does the caller have a point here?
Well, I am not an expert on this legislation, but I do know I'm quite familiar with the caller's point. And as we know, the Bush administration never met a corporation whose pockets it didn't want to fill with more money. And every single policy was either corporate-friendly or, in fact, much worse. We all know the horrible, you know, plundering that basically took place around Iraq and the contracts, the no-bid contracts that were given, and all of the stuff that this administration has done to make corporations wealthier and more powerful at the expense of everyday people. And the failure to institute volume purchasing of prescription drugs is absolutely no exception. It's actually, as awful as it is, it's like one of the lesser of the horrible things that they did. And so the caller is asking what Obama's going to do, and we don't know yet. This poor guy has walked into such an intertwined, kaleidoscope of messes, both domestic and international, that I'm sure they're just struggling to sort out their priorities. And, of course, the first priority, aside from repairing the America's image abroad around torture and Guantanamo Bay and so on and so forth, was the stimulus package. And so, I don't know what he's going to do, and I think, you know, he does have his work cut out for him, as the caller said, because there is such a stranglehold on Congress by these corporate interests. But I'm hoping that he will change this. Not only is the volume purchasing such a giveaway to the drug companies, this entire piece of legislation was so damn confusing and arcane that many seniors could barely sort it out.
And as for the first comment that the caller made, Rush Limbaugh's clarification of his hope that Obama's a failed presidency, is that clarify matters to you, or does that sound like CYA material?
Yeah. You know, not impressed.
Okay.
Not impressed. In fact, because, you know, I saw the footage of Limbaugh. I didn't just read this. I saw the footage of him saying this on the air. And, you know, we know what he really feels. So maybe it's slightly out of context, slightly. But, you know, the Republicans do not want the stimulus package. The two things that they're saying, there's a group of them saying, let's not do anything. Let's not do anything, and let's let the market sort it out. They have not gotten it that neoliberalism is dead. You know, D-O-A, it's dead. And so one group says, don't do anything. And the other group, this is the John McCain group. John McCain, you know, who famously said in September, in the line that cost him the election, the fundamentals of the economy are sound. He is now saying you've got to keep the Bush tax cuts permanent. That is the solution to this disaster.
All right. Our guest, again, Susan Douglas, professor from the University of Michigan. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line two, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, I just have a question. I'm so tired of looking at the media cover anything and everything, but I believe the mainstream media. I can understand why I just surfed and saw Sean Hannity interviewing Rush Limbaugh for the nth time. But when I listen to the ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, elevate Rush Limbaugh to being the leader of the GOP and show him time and time again with his buffoonish comments and statements, I just don't know what's happened to our media. Can you explain to me why would they waste their time with Rush Limbaugh?
Well,
thank you very much, caller, for that call. And if I can ask you, Susan, when you answer that about Rush Limbaugh, talk to, if you wouldn't mind, just about how the conservatives and Republicans, in your view, are regarded by the media compared to how the Democrats were regarded when they were out of power.
Oh, that's a good question, Bob. And I don't quite know the answer to that. But there are a couple of things on the table with this question. And what I would just say back to the caller. Why did Rod Blagojevich get all of that FaceTime on the media earlier this week? What were they thinking? Why would you give that guy, you know, 4 seconds of airtime? And the answer to that question is the same as the answer to the question about Limbaugh. They think that this is going to pull in viewers, not necessarily because they agree with Limbaugh, but they see him as a lightning rod, as controversial. And so if controversy and sensationalism equal sparks, equals ratings, they're going to do it. And we know that, you know, the caller was talking about his being completely fed up with the mainstream news media and how they constantly elevate, you know, certain types like this. I couldn't agree more. You know, it's just become completely banal. I have to say that my fantasy would be to eliminate the cable news channels, all of them, because I think that they have become such a kind of a constantly needy maw for material at the same time that the news organizations have slashed their budgets and slashed international coverage, closed down foreign bureaus, and so on and so forth. So just at the moment when we actually have this delivery service that could give people more news from around the world, more hard news, and so on and so forth, the infrastructure to do that has been removed. And so what is tons cheaper to do is to bring on a controversial talking head like Rush Limbaugh or like Blagojevich. You fill your media time, you get some sparks going, and it costs you tens of thousands of dollars less than covering what's going on in Pakistan or Afghanistan, or in, you know, poor neighborhoods in the United States and so on and so forth. So, you know, those are the interactions of why we get Limbaugh all the time. They need to fill that maw. It's cheap. It's sensational. And now to get to your question, Bob, here's what I think, Bob, I don't know what you would think of this, but, you know, Democrats typically, and Obama in particular, given the 8 years of Bush, is emphasizing transparency. And since the Bush administration was one of the most secretive administrations ever, and was so to the point where Americans became very afraid and suspicious about that, Obama has emphasized transparency, and which Clinton did to a certain extent as well, although he very early on screwed up his relations with the press. As a result, the press feels more emboldened to, you know, investigate, ask questions, take on the administration, so on and so forth. Whereas, certainly in the last 8 years, what we've had is enormous secrecy, the incredible opportunity that 9/11 gave to the Bush administration to bully the press, to beat down the press, and right-wing Republicans helping them do that. So, and I think the combination of the establishment of these various right-wing think tanks that produce various press releases and so on and so forth that shape the news, that can spin people out to go on various of these news programs, and who have beaten the drum over and over, liberal bias, you know, even though it's been documented to be false, I think has intimidated many in the press. You know, NPR now feels it has to have these de rigueur, you know, conservatives on. Well, that's fine if you want to get a you know, range of perspectives, but I'm sorry, I think Bill Kristol is a dope and don't want to hear what he has to say, for example. So I think it's been a combination of the way in which the Democrats themselves seek to do business, some of them, and the way in which the right has successfully intimidated the press.
Before we go back to the phone lines for our guest, Susan Douglas, one more question for you, Susan. Your day job, like my own, is that of being a college professor. You know, sometimes when we talk about cable news like this, and especially the conservative Fox News channel, where I think Bill O'Reilly's average viewer is like 71 years old or something, you know, I wonder, you know, are any of your students watching these networks? Where are they getting their news? I mean, is cable news basically preaching to an old upper middle class group of people who sort of talk amongst themselves, but really it's not filtering to the great mass of this country?
Absolutely. And I'm actually very concerned about this, and I imagine you are too, about the extent to which our students do not follow the news. And, you know, you and I both teach at very good universities that recruit students who are smart, who are hardworking, who care about the world. And yet they know more about who Jennifer Aniston is dating than they do, you know, who's in the cabinet and so on and so forth. And I know this because I poll them on a regular basis about it. And
who is Jennifer Aniston dating then?
Oh, she's dating John Mayer, the singer.
Oh, thank you. Good. I'm glad we clarified that for our listeners.
they know all of this in a heartbeat.
Okay.
And I think part of it is, you know, I think it's a very complicated question. When I was in college, it's not like I read the paper every day, and in fact, a lot of what we read was like I Have Stone's Weekly, but we did follow the news because of the war in Vietnam. And that war in Vietnam, our brothers were there, our boyfriends were there, our cousins were there, you know, and if they weren't there, they were in danger of going there. And the war, plus the student opposition to the war, made it crucial for us to follow the news, and we got into the habit, whether it was watching the nightly news, however intermittently, reading I F Stone, you know, reading the Times, whatever. Our students today have not had to have that habit. They were growing up in the 1990s, you know, which was a time of relative peace and prosperity, and the huge rise of sensationalism and scandal in the news, you know, the O.J. trial, the Lewinsky scandal, on. And by the time they sort of came of age to follow the news, it was the Bush administration, which was very secretive and made it very clear that they were not going to take anybody's opinions into account, grown-ups, non-grown-ups, you know, it was their way or the highway. They told young people, not explicitly but implicitly, to go away. And in fact, it's John Mayer who sang this very famous song that they all know, "Waiting for the World to Change." You know, they were encouraged to have a fatalism and a passivity, and they do. And if you look at the Pew studies about people in the press, and you will find that the audiences for all of the three networks are both declining and aging. And any of us who watch the nightly news, if I see one more Viagra or Cialis commercial, I'm going to scream. But between those and the Polydent commercials and everything else, we know who the news is for. But they don't cover young people. Young people are covered in two ways, when they are victims of crimes and perpetrators of crimes. Issues of concern to young people are not there. So they are. It's a vicious cycle. And I think one of the things that I'm passionate about, actually, that I want to talk to you about some other time, is and I think colleges and universities, I think we have to start doing something to partner with newspapers and figure out what we're going to do about our students' civic knowledge and civic engagement, because I think the commercial media have not served them well at all. Where do they get the news? If they get it, they get it from The Daily Show. That's where they get it. And in fact, many of them feel that The Daily Show is a much more accurate representation of the news than the news is, in part because, you know, Stewart does all that historical stuff where he juxtaposes what a politician said, you know, at point A in time versus what the politician said at point B in time. He holds them up to their own words. He really makes fun of cable news. They feel like they're getting much more accurate news than they do, you know, from, say, the nightly news shows, which they can't watch. They also go to the Internet intermittently, but they're not following the news, and I bet yours aren't either.
Our guest, Susan Douglas, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesson, here in WILLA and 580. Come to you live February 1st, 2009. The number here at the studio is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Let's go to that caller now. Line 1, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Hi, Professor Douglas. My name is Matthew Murray, and I've been doing a critique of NPR on a blog for about 2 years, and on NPR of NPR News's coverage, and I have to say I've been just struck by how NPR seems to really just represent often the State Department or the Pentagon's point of view on a variety of topics. And I would just be curious to hear what your take is on that, or if you or any of your colleagues have done research on NPR News and sort of their political take on stories. So I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thanks, Matthew. I'm glad you're doing this. I'll go look for your blog. You know, I have not been doing any, you know, say, quantitative or even qualitative content analysis about how things have shifted over time, but I think we all perceive that a major shift has occurred. And this shift really began in the 1990s when Bob Dole was the Senate Majority Leader and periodically would threaten to cut the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because his argument that was that PBS and NPR represented sort of the worst of liberal bias. And at one point, I can't remember if it was Fred Barnes or Charles Krauthammer, one of these conservative columnists was on a kind of a tear about NPR basically being kind of a communist radio station. And these threats are very serious for NPR because they do rely on the funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to keep going. And so they can't just laugh this kind of stuff off. So I think you really began to see much more accommodation to the right and also more reliance on official sources from political elites as things moved along. What is really exciting thing to do, and Matthew, I don't know if you've had a chance to do this, but if one goes back and listens to really early All Things Considered, the first All Things Considered, which was in May of God, I'm trying to think, it was 1970 or 71 now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think 70 or 71.
Yeah, and it opened with a major anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C., and the demonstrators shut down traffic in the city. And during that entire broadcast and subsequent ones, I think what was so brilliant about early All Things Considered is they didn't want to talk primarily to political elites or only to political elites. They wanted to talk to people in the streets. And you heard African-American voices in that show. You're like, what? An African-American person on the street commenting about a political demonstration and politics? It was very bracing. And those early heady years of All Things Considered in NPR provide such a striking contrast to what we hear today, which is more mainstream, more corporate, so on and so forth. Now, having said that, I still think, and agreeing with everything you said, Matthew, I still think NPR is one of the best sources of news we have, despite everything, especially if one's NPR outlet has the various, you know, talk shows and so on and so forth. So there we go. But I will look at your blog, and I think your impressions are completely right. And I don't know if anybody's doing a detailed analysis of NPR's change in sort of political valence, but Bob, you may know.
Well, not off the top of my head, you know, but let me ask you one question, Susan Douglas, which is, you know, over the last several years, the argument that has been made, not simply by Republicans, but mostly, has been that with the emergence of cable television and multi-channel television and satellites with hundreds of channels, and especially with the emergence of the internet and the blogosphere, there's really no longer any justification for having a publicly subsidized public radio or television system, that it's really antiquated. What do you make of that argument?
I think it's a specious argument, and it is, of course, a perfect argument for in support of commercial interests. It's an argument that began in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan and with his FCC commissioner, Mark Fowler, who wanted to bring market considerations only to bear on the regulation of, you know, our radio and television stations, and argued that because of cable, back then, this was before the internet, they were arguing that because of cable in particular and the proliferation of various outlets, that the government no longer had to be a custodian ensuring that diverse viewpoints, you know, got on the air. And so, of course, as many people know, in 1987, they eliminated the Fairness Doctrine, and Congress sought to override that decision, and Reagan vetoed it, and we have not had a Fairness Doctrine since 1987, and that's why we can get Rush Limbaugh and G. Gordon Liddy and all of these right-wingers, you know, on and on and on. And so that's been their argument since the 80s, and what they are counting on people not paying attention to is, or noting, is that the scarcest resource all of us have is our attention. Attention is a very scarce resource. And when you don't have a lot of time and attention and you're told, well, you know, you just go find it and, you know, we don't really need publicly funded broadcasting anymore because you can go online, there are serious problems, I think, both with that ethically and in terms of our ability to access knowledge. But also the way the internet works is, you know, we can do me news, right? You know, I can go in and go to Yahoo News or whatever and say, I only want entertainment news and sports. And I would never have to look at a headline about politics or the world again. So that's a feature of the internet that can further narrow people's, information. And so I think it's a very specious argument, and of course, various of us have been fighting against that.
Susan Douglas, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We have another caller to go to who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Effingham, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Yes, I'm in complete agreement with Professor Douglas, and I am a senior citizen, 75 years old, and I have watched, I've been exposed to the media my whole life, movies especially, and some radio, and the movie industry in the 1950s opted for violence, and the how that was appearing on television. Movies followed, and now we have television these days where the big three networks from 8 o'clock in the evening until 10 or so is the egregious violence that is fed to the public with the uniformed police looking like black soldiers. And all these things that are articulated on that, we hate this group and we shoot this group, and it's a mix of races who do the shooting and who are being shot. And it is appalling to me that it goes on constantly. And the movies, I revisited Clint Eastwood this past week, the same old stuff, good guy, bad guy, minorities dead. By old men like Eastwood now, who had his days on Rawhide and all that crap. It is, just seems to me that if the new generation, people who are teen and somewhat post-teen, as you just said about Jennifer Aniston and John Mayer, if the attention to these folks is drawn in by the things that they watch on TV and at movie houses and things on the radio and the Cromwell Group, I'm almost sickened by that. And how it has played out, and what we think the next generation is going to be. I guess that's my question, and thanks for letting me run on.
Thank you very much for calling, sir. Susan Douglas, any comments?
Yes, I have two colleagues who whose work is focused entirely around media violence and aggression. And one of my colleagues, Raoul Huseman, has been studying this for decades and decades now. And he has ample evidence that media violence is a public health hazard, particularly to young people. Now, what he has to fight against is that people say, oh, you're saying that if my kid plays a violent video game or watches a violent movie, he's going to go shoot somebody. And, well, my kid's watched a violent movie, hasn't shot anybody, and therefore you're wrong, right? And that is not the argument at all. There are certain people in our society who are, for a variety of reasons, very shaped by and susceptible to the kind of scripts about violence that come off in the media and are repeated. And those scripts, in a nutshell, suggest that the best, easiest, least complicated way to solve problems is through violence, and especially gun violence. And that is a script that many of us imbibed at a very young age. And so I think the caller is completely right. There is, from the studies that I know about, violence has not decreased in television or in the movies. And now there has been a proliferation of more cable channels where, you know, in some places you can avoid it more. But this country has been much more worried about sex in the media than violence, when so much of the evidence shows that media violence is actually a public health hazard.